Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Coming up later, we'll get the lowdown on the new iPad, why it doesn't have its own special name, and what makes it special. With Geek.com's Russell Holly, we'll also hear about what's happening at the South by Southwest Conference in Austin with PC World's Steve Fox. Right now, it's time to think about treasure hunting. If you've never heard of geocaching before, this might help.
Geocaching is a high-tech treasure hunting game played throughout the world by adventure seekers equipped with GPS devices. The basic idea is to go outside and locate hidden containers called geocaches using a GPS-enabled device. The GPS coordinates of geocaches are listed on geocaching.com. All you need to do is plug these coordinates into your GPS device and head outside to find the cache. Geocaching is a great way to explore locations near and far. With over a million geocaches hidden worldwide, there are geocaches for every type of adventurer to find.
Joining us now by phone from Washington State to talk about the explosion in geocaching around the world is Eric Shadisky of Groundspeak. It's a web manager for geocaching.com. Welcome to the show, Eric.
Hi, Ann. Thanks for having us.
Also joining us is local geocacher Barry Schieferstein. He manages the Central Ohio Geocachers Facebook page. Welcome, Barry.
Good morning.
Question for listeners. Have you geocached in Central Ohio? Give us a call and tell us what you think about it. Tell us what you've done and what sort of adventures you've had. 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. So, Eric Shadisky, tell us, when did geocaching take off?
So geocaching has been around since 2000. The site geocaching.com launched in 2000 with just 75 geocaches listed on the site around the world. And as you just heard in that little clip, that there are now more than 1 million geocaches listed around the world some 11, 12 years later. And we're actually up to about 1.7 million geocaches around the world. And that in Ohio, there's about 23,000. Geocaches. And I checked yesterday and then I checked today, and just overnight, 12 new geocaches have been published or placed in Ohio. So this is a rapidly growing activity that families and adventurers and people who really want to use technology to enable themselves to get outdoors and not be kind of cloistered inside, further away from people, further away from their community, to embark on a little bit of an adventure that's of their choosing. They can choose how difficult it is. There's a rating system and what sort of terrain they want to encounter. And then inside the geocache world or geocaching world, there's different types of geocaches people can choose to find, whether they need to solve a puzzle before finding it or whether it's extra cleverly hidden, if that's the term, or if it's something you might just find in a hedge outside your house. Most people are within in Ohio, maybe a quarter mile or definitely within a mile of a geocache.
Now, you know, it said in that little clip, so you can find the cache, which I mean is C-A-C-H-E, not C-A-S-H. But typically, what is a cache? What do you find?
So people will find a physical container. And in the container, at the bare minimum, will be a log sheet that people will sign their username. And everyone in geocaching, when you sign up to the site, and it's free, you go to geocaching.com, you create a persona or a username, and some people have really clever usernames. So on that log sheet in the cache, you'll sign your username to prove that you're physically there and found this cache. You know, the idea is that it gets you outside and allows you to see the world around you or the world when you travel and find unique places. So you'll find a small container. They can be as small, and Barry can testify to this, as small as like the head of an eraser on a pencil, or they can be as large as a car. There's a car somewhere in the world that's a geocache. So they can really vary in size, which increases the mental challenge when you're hunting for a geocache, because you can look at clues and hints and kind of gauge what you might be looking for. But at the bare minimum, you'll find a log sheet in the geocache for you to sign your name. And then if it's a larger geocache, there'll also be items for trade. So small trinkets that you can take as long as you put something in of equal or greater value. And then there's these items called trackables, which move from geocache to geocache and are moved by geocachers. So you can place a trackable, log it on the website, and give it a mission. And then someone will find it in a geocache and say you want this trackable to go to Paris. That person would then find that out by logging onto the website and putting in the trackable ID, and then maybe move it one step closer, maybe take it to a geocache by the Columbus airport so someone could then pick it up on their way out of town. So there's a lot of different items that you'll generally find in a geocache, but they're mostly family-friendly items that that kids or people can trade for, or signature items for geocachers.
This is All Sides.
That shows that they're there.
This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. You're listening to Eric Shadisky. He is with Groundspeak. It's the web manager for geocaching.com. Of course, we'll post that on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. Also with me, Barry Schievenstein. He's a Central Ohio geocacher. He manages the Central Ohio Geocachers Facebook page. Barry, how did you get into geocaching?
Well, I got into it with a friend of mine from South Carolina, actually, and he had been doing it and came up to visit us for an event, and he took us out geocaching, and I had heard about it before, being in electronics as I am. But we went out and did a couple caches, and I thought this is a good way to get outside and enjoy some time with my son. So we picked up a GPS unit and started geocaching, and quickly we were both addicted to it. And my wife also joins us every now and then.
Eric, you know, obviously this came along with the popularization, the democratization, I guess, of the GPS.
Mm-hmm.
But was there one person who started it?
So back in 2000, as soon as GPS signals were refined so that the general population could use GPS with much more accuracy. So in early, mid-2000, it's called the big blue switch was flipped, and then the accuracy of all GPS devices increased tenfold because the military no longer scrambled the signal. So then a gentleman named Dave Altner placed what he called a stash somewhere outside of Portland and on the Internet, which was just a fledgling idea at the time.
That's right.
Challenged other people to find it. And that just clicked somewhere in a collective consciousness that was something that really engaged people on a very basic level. You know, you got to be a treasure hunter once again. You got to be an 8-year-old on an adventure and finding something that you wouldn't find, and it's has that kind of swashbuckling aspect to it. So this gentleman, Dave Altner, placed the original stash cache, and then 2 days later, someone found it, just followed the GPS device. And GPS devices are accurate within about 30 feet. So once you get to a location, you still really have to use your problem-solving skills and just have a hyper-awareness of the area to find the cache. And that was 2000, and it started growing. And then the founders of geocaching.com, just three gentlemen from Seattle, Washington, who started the website in a basement, decided that this was something that needed to be a little bit larger, and started posting and maintaining a website just dedicated to geocaching. And that's kind of how it was born so many years ago. And as far as the .com, we've got a big gray beard. We're old.
Exactly.
Yeah, you know, 12 years old, but still it's something that people are discovering, and it really ignites a spirit of adventure in people just to get outside and have a reason to go to the park down the street or to go tromping in the woods at night. One of the most popular geocache in all of Ohio is a cache that can only be done at night.
Well, how does that work?
So you use a flashlight, and there'll be reflectors. Pinned into trees that you wouldn't see during the day. But at night, you can see them and you follow a trail. That's generally how it works. I'm not sure on the specifics on this cache, which is just outside of Columbus, called the Seven Realms of Darkness. very dramatic.
Barry Schieferstein, have you ever done anything like that? What are some of the more interesting caches you've done?
I've actually done that cache. It is up near Westerville, near Hoover Reservoir. And it is a very fun cache. It can only be done at night, like Eric said, with flashlights and reflectors. And we did it over the winter with a large group of people, which is the most fun way to do it.
To go without a big, we go with a big group.
Oh yeah, it can be a social activity, and that's one of the reasons why I enjoy my time with Central Ohio Geocachers. It's the camaraderie of it.
Have you stashed caches yourself?
I have. I have about 20 actual containers out, and I've done 3 event caches, which what those are is they're a one-time thing where people show up for a reason, and Central Ohio Geocachers has a couple of those a month.
What is some of the most interesting things you found?
Some of the most interesting things I found, I think it's more of the places that geocaching takes us.
Then tell us that.
There's places that we've found that you would never find had it not been for geocaching. The small little cemetery is a quarter mile down a dirt road that you never knew was there.
Mm-hmm.
We recently did one, another popular one here in Ohio, in Wapakoneta. It's actually a rock garden in a gentleman's backyard, and it was just a phenomenal experience. We went up there with a large group of people for that one as well.
Eric Shadisky, what are some of the big, is Ohio considered a very active geocache state, or is it typical, or what?
It's a pretty active geocaching state. There's actually what are called mega events, where you have more than 500 people attend one event just for the purpose of talking about geocaching and building the community around geocaching. And Barry really hit it on the head when he talked about how geocaching really fosters community, because it's sharing. You go out, you have an experience, you go back online, and you share your experience with the community by writing a log about how you found the cache, and you can go into as much detail as you want. And you really get to know people's usernames, and then you see them in the field or out geocaching or arrange to go with large groups, like Barry said. But there's a large mega event on July 26th called the Midwest Geo Bash, just west of Toledo, and there'll be more than 500 people there for several days who will go geocaching and talk about GPS devices and really get into the hobby and share that experience, because it's really about being outside and experiencing and sharing these experiences with other people. So Ohio is a great state for that. You know, they're adventurous individuals who really have a love for the outdoors, and Barry has the history of having some technology in their background and wanting to really use technology to add purpose and add a little bit of joy to their lives.
Can geocaching, Barry, be dangerous? I mean, do you need to really make sure you know where you're going and that sort of thing?
Well, it can be. As Eric mentioned, there is a terrain rating in all the geocaches, and that's one of the things I guess we're kind of unique here in Central Ohio in that we don't have the mountains of the West or the oceans, but we do have trees. And Central Ohio has a very active recreational tree climbing community. And geocaching goes along with that. I have actually found a cache 90 feet into a tree.
Gosh, that sounds like another show.
It could be.
Well, Eric Shadisky, thanks for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you, Ann, and thanks, Barry.
Eric is social media manager for Groundspeak. That's the web manager for geocaching.com. And also, Barry Schieferstein, glad you could join us today.
Well, thank you.
Barry manages the Central Ohio Geocachers Facebook page. We'll have links to both of those on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. Coming up, we're going to talk about South by Southwest. So stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Where do you go for great conversation on the topics that matter the most? The radio is more responsive than the water cooler, and we take your calls. I'm Jennifer Ludden. If you're talking about it, we're probably talking about it too. Join us for provocative talk on the issues you care about. Next, Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
Talk of the Nation this afternoon from 2 until 4. This is 89.7 NPR News, 63 degrees in downtown Columbus. With some clouds right now, expect sunshine today, partly sunny skies, a high of 72. Clear skies for tonight, a low of 47 degrees. Sunshine and a nice day for Wednesday, a high of 76.
Support for 89.7 comes from Edible Columbus, a magazine devoted to culinary traditions, seasonal cooking, and the local food movement in our community. More information on the spring edition coming March 20th can be found at ediblecolumbus.com.
All Sides with Ann Fisher, Tech Tuesday continues on 89.7 NPR News.
It's Tech Tuesday on All Sides. Coming up later, we'll get the lowdown on the new iPad, why it doesn't have its own special name, and what makes it special with Geek.com's Russell Holly. Right now, we turn to the South by Southwest Music Conference and Festival, but not to be confused with Woodstock. Yesterday, CNN called the multi-day event in Austin, Texas, a nerd circus. Here's another take.
It's powerful. We are architects and product designers and communicators all wrapped into one. The interactive community is the connective tissue between all of these universes. This is the time to use the innate qualities of being an interactive person to apply them to making change. We don't have the luxury of deciding whether or not we're going to do this. And it's your turn now.
So, Geekdom never sounded so good, so cool. Joining us now to give us his take on South by Southwest is Steve Fox, Editorial Director and Vice President of PC World in San Francisco. Welcome back to the show, Steve.
Good to be back, Ann.
I mean, it just sounds positively groovy down there.
Well, yeah, well, and it very much is in Austin. It's interesting you say Geekdom, in this case, I think it's also never sounded more sort of socially conscious, or for that matter, more inclined to tackle big questions. You know, we think about a lot of these tech shows, and there are many of them. They're about, you know, bits and bytes and introducing the latest product and talking about that sort of thing. But in many ways, South by Southwest, and by the way, if you want to sound cool on this,
South
you don't call it South by Southwest, you just call it South by.
I know, but, right. You know.
Okay, there you go. yeah. So, you know, if you're at South by, you're really thinking about sort of life's big questions and how technology and the role of technology might play in them. So, you know, for example, you might have, I know Rainn Wilson was talking, I think it was like Saturday or Sunday, and he was saying, well, you know, here's how to chew on life's big questions and talking about politics and freedom and art and creativity. You had yesterday, I think it was Al Gore got up and announced that we have to figure out how to occupy democracy. He was talking with Sean Parker of Facebook fame and, you know, basically how you can take control of the information that you get. And you know, in this way, you exert more control by using technology. So these are kind of the uber themes.
Yeah, because, you know, you have this image of the geeks or the nerds or whatever being distant and being unconnected or disconnected from what the rest of us are doing and the visuals you get. And, of course, that was a very promotional audio clip we heard.
So you expect a clip like that to be – let's say optimistic, right?
Yeah, and when you look at it and when you just go online and just check out the video from the conference, it does look everyone's very engaged, very involved with each other, and they're really, really talking about things, and you do get that feeling. South By's interactive trade show runs through today, I guess. So
yes, it does.
And, you know, just as recently as 2007, which I know is like the Stone Age among technorati, but South By was considered the launching pad for startup entrepreneurs. Now, one venture capitalist in one story I read said he counsels his startups to avoid that tack because it's too crowded. Go have fun, meet people, but don't try to launch anything.
It's just the Yogi Berra thing about no one goes to that restaurant anymore. It's way too crowded.
Right.
So I think there is something of that there. I mean, the reality of South By these days is that this is a tribal gathering. It's a tribal gathering of geeks, but those geeks attract another very important group, and those would be the suits. So, you know, despite someone saying, I advise you not to launch things there or whatever, there's a lot of launches that go on there, and the suits are all out there trying to figure out what's the next big thing so that they can throw money at it, so that ultimately money gets thrown at them. The geeks are there both both trying to be discovered, but, you know, more than that, reveling in the wonder that is South by Southwest. You know, because keep in mind, people used to think of South by Southwest strictly as a music festival for quite some time. And, you know, it's Austin. Everyone knows this is what Austin is famous for. And this thing has been around, I don't know, since the late 80s, primarily as a music festival. And then they added film and interactive. By interactive, it's basically internet stuff and these days apps, and more apps.
Yes.
And I think in some ways the app piece of it has become more important, only in that there's so much money that's floating around based upon the interactive elements. Now, it's kind of interesting here. You mentioned that, you know, seeing the clips and everything, mm-hmm. you see everyone really connected, and that seems to be a theme very much of this particular South by Southwest. Let me give you an example. Everyone tries to pick, you know, what's the hot introduction, right? Everyone knows that Twitter was introduced a number of years ago at South by. Foursquare several years ago as well. So those were the big hits. No one's calling anything the big hit right now, but there is a, call it a theme, if you will, that is running throughout a lot of these announcements. And it's this idea of sort of ambient social, which sounds somewhat ridiculous, but here's the point. If you have one of these apps, and there are a number of them, if you have one of these apps on your phone or whatever, it will tell you if anyone is anywhere in your vicinity that you're connected to in any way. I mean, you know, especially on any kind of social media. It could be, friend of a friend on Facebook. It could, you know, there's all kinds of connections. Mm-hmm. And the piece that everyone is talking about is a little app called Highlight. And Highlight does just that. It'll you know, beep when anyone is near you. So it's location aware. And it's really, think of it as a people discovery engine. And I would say, of all of the things that have been introduced this year at South By, Highlight is probably getting the most talk, but it's not the only one. There's another one called Glancee, that's G-L-A-N-C-E-E, does the same thing. There's a big list that I was made up here because I've been reading about
them. Well, I was reading through a list, Glancee, CardSpring.
Yeah.
Sonar.
Mm-hmm. Kismet.
Yeah.
Banjo, Uber Life.
I didn't see Banjo, but Uber Life,
okay.
Yeah.
Okay, so this is a wild idea that all of these entrepreneurs and tech folk have gotten together, gone off on their own, and come back to South By with essentially very similar apps doing the same thing. Now, you can think of it one way as, wow, what a handy thing to have in a collection of thousands and thousands and thousands of geeks, being able to mill among them and figure out, you know, who you can party with and go to the next great band at the show. So there's a very specific use at South by Southwest. What the entrepreneurs and others will be betting on is whether something like this plays out in the general populace.
You know, it is kind of an odd thought. Every once in a while, I meet somebody on that I know from Facebook but don't know personally, and it's always mm-hmm. a weird idea, always a weird experience. In a way, this would kind of advance that, take it a step, several steps ahead.
Yes, it would. I mean, and some of that may not make us all that comfortable because you were talking about Facebook friends, and you and I have talked about this before. There are Facebook friends who are, you know, strictly Facebook friends,
right,
in quotes, and you might not want to meet them. On the other hand, we've had the experience at PC World. You know, many of us have Twitter accounts, and we'll go to a city and we'll announce a tweet up, and people who follow us will show up. And actually, those have worked really nicely in terms of you're pulling together a group of people who have some sort of connection and a common interest, which has they themselves have specified because of, you know, they're either following you, you're following them, whatever. And, you know, it facilitates some kind of interactions in the real world. So it's an interesting idea, and I am not entirely convinced that it's going to really play out all that well. I don't think this is the next Twitter or Foursquare, but, you know, if nothing else, I'm consistently underestimating the power of some of these things, and let's see how that plays out.
Well, I didn't think soft soap would make it, so I am no visionary.
There you go. You know, you were the one who bet against Febreze, right?
Go ahead.
I was going to say there's some interesting things. I think what will come out of this South By is something that's not being made quite as much fuss about, but I think is potentially a bigger deal. And that is there's a number of companies out there that are looking at voice over IP, VoIP, as a way to make phone calls and do, connections and the like, and trying to make this just, dead simple. So that you can make calls either for free or for a very small amount of money on your mobile device or even from your computer. And I think, people obviously are using VoIP as it is. We have Skype and everything else. But if those can be made really simple, this has the potential to really undermine this whole the wireless behemoth, of the wireless carriers. So, we've seen there's a company called Vox.io that one of our reporters played with and really enjoyed. There's another Mai. I don't really know how to pronounce it, but I think it's Mai, M-A-I-I. Mm-hmm. And it's a way of doing this kind of voice calling. And, it's free to another user or very cheap to mobile and landlines. And it's not that the technology is new. VoIP has been around for quite some time. But it's still a little dicey for regular humans to do it. You start getting it, so you just install an app and hit a button, and you can call people. Well, of course, we can do that with our phones, but basically getting around the cellular carriers, I think that could be a big deal, and I think we'll be seeing a lot more of that over the next year.
My guest is Steve Fox. He's editorial director and vice president of PC World. If you have a question or comment for Steve, you can give us a call. He'll be with us for another 8 or so minutes, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. But get it in quick. Steve will only be with us for another 8 minutes or so.
I'm going to jump in and say there is one thing I wanted to talk about that is so weird and so seemingly tasteless that it just needs to be brought up.
Please
here.
Do.
Okay. Yeah. with a setup like that, how can you resist?
Exactly.
Right? So there's some marketing company out there at South By right now that is pushing something called homeless hotspots.
Oh, yes, I read about that. Yes.
Okay. So this is not a product. This is a marketing gimmick, and I guess – you could say it has worked because here we are talking about it.
Right.
Essentially, they've taken they've hired 13 or so homeless people, given them a device, I assume like an internet access point, that's a hotspot, and they have signs that say I'm a homeless hotspot, and they walk around, and for I think it's $2 for 15 minutes, you can get internet access, essentially Wi-Fi from the homeless hotspot. That money, the company says, is actually going to support the homeless and other things. There is a certain tone deafness around this that I find just stunning. It feels like the purchase of humans is not something that that most of us would recommend.
And yet, I saw a lot of different opinions on that. One homeless guy said, hey, it's an opportunity for me. Someone else said they do the newspapers, where they sell the newspapers on the streets. I don't know if they do that in San Francisco or not.
Oh, absolutely.
Right,
yes,
sure. And, I actually was reading more of the chat about it after I read the article than I did the article itself, just listening to people debate the ethics of it.
Right, and so this brings together lots of it's homeless hotspots, but it's actually a social hotspot as well, you could say,
mm-hmm.
because it is a litmus test in terms of how we feel about this sort of thing. I guess the good part is it initiates discussion about homelessness, it raises mm-hmm. consciousness, and as you pointed out, it's also some money for a very short period of time, but some money for some folks who actually were not working before. But it has, so in that way, it has very much done what it was meant to do, which is get people talking about it. I'd say one of the other things people were talking about, and moving very far away from homeless, or let's move straight into outer space, and that would be Angry Birds in space.
Right.
So Angry Birds in Space, or Angry Birds Space, is an all new version of the very popular game from Rovio, and it's been rolled out at South by Southwest, and from what I can tell on this, it looks like it's a version of Angry Birds that really tweaks gravity and lets you play with the birds in different scenarios. And of course, we know how tremendously popular Angry Birds is to begin with. So, you know, let's move them into another realm, in this case space, and, you know, let's let NASA play with this one and, you know, see how it works. But it's, I suspect, going to be quite popular.
You know, yesterday and today, 66 startup companies pitched their ideas to live audiences. There's, something like 600-plus startups auditioned for this, and they get to do it. What's that like? They pitch their ideas to a live audience, I should say. What happens
right.
with that?
It's sort of like the Romans with the thumbs up and thumbs down.
Okay.
But in many ways, really, it's how it plays out later. You know, after those presentations, then everyone goes off and writes in their blogs about it, and slowly opinions form based on that. So, you know, as I said, right now, based upon what everyone was running back from the presentations with, everyone was talking about Highlight.
Yeah. Okay.
Who knows what it'll be next? I know a lot of people are excited about Instagram, which is, you know, that's the photo sharing app that. You know, many of us know from iOS, from, you know, iPhone and elsewhere, but that's being rolled out for Android. So, you know, in this case, you take an app that almost everyone here is using on their iPhones, and you announce up, it's also here for Android. That's the kind of thing that gets a lot of buzz.
Oh, okay.
Especially because you don't really need to explain how it works, because everyone already knows how it works from their existing devices. So that's certainly one that's getting some buzz.
Andrew in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Andrew.
I have a question. I kind of feel like at this point, being at the end of the show, it's almost a question you could have a whole show about. But I was just wondering what his thoughts are, or any other information that he has about the bandwidth situation we have in America. I work for a national cell phone company, and I know that's a hot topic that we often discuss in business. I'll take my answer off the air.
Okay. Thanks, Andrew.
Thank okay. And yes, that is a topic for several hours. I think most people know that bandwidth in the United States, we are nowhere near, say, you know, the Koreas of the world and others. In fact, the state of bandwidth for us in terms of, you know, mobile getting, you know, fast internet connections and the like, is nowhere near what it is in the rest of the world. And we do have some rollouts from, you know, obviously there's the 4G stuff. So that's, you know, on the cellular side, we're working to get some of the other, you know, other connections faster. But, you know, this is something that in a lot of countries, the government itself ends up pouring money into it. And that's something that at this point is not necessarily happening in the U.S. And there's an argument that sort of the lack of bandwidth has the potential to cripple innovation, because a lot of the kind of apps and and internet and sites and the rest require great speed and high bandwidth. Then again, you look at what's going on at South by Southwest, and you say, well, if this is the crippled innovation, you know, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of companies pouring out new things, all kinds of really very interesting ideas, then if this is the crippled version, that's really not too bad.
But people think, come from all over the world to South by. Is it necessarily dominated by American startups?
Oh, well, there are a lot of American startups, but, you know, like, for instance, I was mentioning Vox.io. That's overseas. A lot of these are overseas firms. People do come here because the consumers are here,
right.
And that's what a lot of it is about. So it's very much an international show. Of course, they also come because then after the interactive portion, they can hang around and hear some amazing music over, you know, the next 3, 4, 5 days, because it's the whole conference itself is 10 days. The interactive part is, you know, three or so days.
Right.
So, you know, it is a magnet, no doubt about it.
Well, Steve Fox, thanks for joining us today to tell us all about it.
This was fun.
All right. Steve Fox, he's editorial director and vice president of PC World. Coming up, Russell Holly from Geek.com. Stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
On the next Fresh Air, why the flushing toilet took 2 centuries to catch on, why strangers used to share their beds, and why kitchens used to be cut off from the rest of the home. We talk with Lucy Worsley about her new book, If Walls Could Talk, An Intimate History of the Home. She hosted a BBC series on the same subject. She's chief curator of historic royal palaces in England. Join us.
Fresh Air begins in 20 minutes. It starts at noon on 89.7 NPR News. Your annual support of 89.7 is our largest source of income. Your gifts make up the funds we use to pay for the news programs you listen to every day. It's easy to renew your membership. Visit us online at WOSU.org/renew. Call 1-866-897-9678 or respond to our mailing by sending a generous check. Your annual gift provides us with the foundation of listener support. Thank you for renewing your membership with 89.7 NPR News.
Support for 89.7 comes from the Physicians Free Clinic and Voluntary Care Network, providing charity medical care for Central Ohio's uninsured patients. More about joining the Columbus Medical Association Foundation and supporting the clinic is at goodhealthcolumbus.org.
Partly sunny skies today and a high right around 70 degrees. Clear skies tonight, a low of 47. All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
It's not the iPad 3 or the iPad anything special. It's just the new iPad, which is kind of scary in an age of families of technology. When each innovation should be getting its own name, at least that's what we've been trained to think. Joining us now to talk about the new iPad is our regular Geek.com blogger, Russell Holly. Welcome back, Russell.
Thanks for having me back.
So let's get this name issue dealt with right away. Why isn't the new iPad getting a new name? Like iPad,
well,
you know, blah, blah.
There's been a lot of speculation about that. No one really seems to have a solid answer. And the biggest thing that I can come up with after thinking about it for a while is that that's how people are already going to call it. Yes, you know, we are certainly in an age where, you know, we want things to be named in some kind of either chronological or, you know, alphabetical order.
Or by dessert or whatever.
You know, by dessert. But when people go into a store, the thing that they're going to say when they walk into an Apple store or a Best Buy, they're going to say, do you guys have the new iPad?
Mm-hmm. It is catchy. So the new iPad screen resolution is getting a lot of attention. Not as much as its name, but so how great is the screen resolution? What's your review?
It's going to be a higher screen resolution than your television, than, you know, your computer. It's going to be the highest resolution screen that you've basically have ever picked up.
How are they doing that?
A significant thing. Well, the screen for the iPhone 4 and the iPhone 4S both had what Apple called a Retina display, and it was extremely dense set of pixels on a screen where, you know, everything was very, very tightly packed. It was an extremely high quality screen, but it's expensive, very expensive to make those screens any bigger than the just over 3 inches that the iPhone screen is. And what they've done with the iPad was take that same technology and just made a bigger screen.
Well, does that mean the new iPad is going to be a lot more expensive?
They managed to keep it the same price. And honestly, I think that that's mostly because, you know, the screen for the iPad is now 2 years behind the screen for the iPhone 4. You know, the iPhone 4 came out and was out for a year, and then the iPhone 4S came out and has been out for a little while. Mm-hmm. And so now, you know, the iPad is just... It's taken them almost that 2 years to manage to bring you that same screen quality, that same pixel density, and keep the cost the same.
We have an email from Angel. She says, my dad bought what was the latest iPad, but now Apple is introducing yet another. I never hear tech experts mention how this seems really exploitive. They sell products that can be three times the price of similar electronics and then promptly make these products obsolete. Apple is like a luxury car or a luxury company. They aren't selling a product, but a belief that the customer is cutting edge. I think a Mercedes or Louis Vuitton bag holds its value longer. Well, for my dad, ignorance is bliss because it will be months before he knows there is a new iPad. What do you say, Russell?
So Apple's products are designed in kind of a unique way, in my opinion, in that you don't, if you buy, you know, whatever you think the latest version of an Apple product is, be it, you know, the iPhone 4 or the iPad 2, you don't necessarily need the next latest and greatest version. For example, people who bought an iPhone 4, you know, let's say, you know, 6 months ago or even 7 or 8 months ago, they didn't really need to get an iPhone 4S. The difference wasn't significant enough that they needed to, you know, spend that extra money to get the device out of contract. The iPhone that comes after the iPhone 4S may be something that they're interested in because the difference between the two devices will be staggering enough. And the same, in my opinion, goes for, you know, people who are looking at the new iPad who already have an iPad 2.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the iPad 2, the difference between these two devices, the screen quality is definitely a big thing here, but the devices have very similar internal, you know, hardware, and you already have the same version of the operating system. You sit these two devices side by side, and you'll see a higher quality screen, but the performance difference isn't going to be that big.
And the screen's fine on the iPad, too. It's just, it's
absolutely
from good to great. My guest is Russell Holly. He's a tech blogger at geek.com. If you have a question or comment for him, we're talking about the new iPad. Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. So the current apps, those are all going to be still okay. You can just use the same stuff.
Oh, absolutely.
No change. And
everything's going to run exactly the same as it did. You know, the iPad 2 and the new iPad, everything is going to look the same as far as how apps are run and everything like that. Apple will do a really good job with that.
There was a question I saw about whether the new iPad screen offers pressure sensitivity or haptic feedback. What is that?
Haptic feedback is a special way to respond. It's really a tactile response.
Uh-huh.
So when you touch the screen, something special would happen, something different than, you know, most devices give you that you know, that little bit of vibrate or something like that when you touch and an action happens. And there was a lot of speculation when the new iPad was coming up, that, you know, the rumors that were coming in was that it was going to have, you know, a special surface that would allow for, you know, a more interactive experience when you were to touch things. And that wasn't a feature that came out.
The new screens effect on battery life do they have to ramp up the battery, or is it not going to make that much difference?
Apple claims that the battery life for these devices is going to be just about the same as they did for the previous version. They say that it's going to be, you know, a 10-hour battery as you go to use it. However,
mm-hmm.
You know, the device is also just a little tiny bit thicker and just a little tiny bit heavier than the previous iPad. And there's a lot of speculation that the reason for that is that they dumped a much bigger battery in this device so that it can, you know, give you that same experience.
Then there, the front camera is the same, meaning the one that you pointed others, but the back camera has been improved.
The back camera is now a 5-megapixel camera. It is more than likely the exact same camera that's in the iPhone 4,
mm-hmm.
which was always capable of taking very good pictures.
And was there a big demand for that? Was that something that, I mean, is the new iPad a response to criticisms or complaints about iPad 2?
No, I think that, you know, this is just the evolution of the device. Apple mm-hmm. has a release cycle for all of their products where they release a new version of that device every year. And I think that, you know, a lot of Apple's competitors have been focusing on faster processors and faster graphics. And for a lot of their devices, you know, that their competitors have been releasing have been, you know, higher quality screens where they've been, you know, 1080p high definition screens that have been put in these devices. And so Apple just took their existing technology and, you know, used it to release a competitive product.
Guest is Russell Holly, tech blogger at geek.com. Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can tweet us at Ann Fisher, WOSU, as did Jason. He writes, I am disappointed Siri is not on the new iPad. I have iPad 2 and will wait for iPad 6, which will hopefully have Siri. That is if they call it iPad 6, Jason. But what about that, Russell?
So what they did was they included the ability to, you know, have the voice dictate from Siri, but the actual Siri application was not included with the iPad. And I think there's a big reason for that in how you're going to use Siri. You're not going to use Siri exactly the same way on an iPad as you would on an iPhone. And I think that that requires a little bit of reimagining on Apple's part. I mean, a lot of what happens on Siri for the iPhone, from my understanding, is, you know, communication for basic tasks. You know,
yeah.
Send someone a text message, set a reminder for myself. With an iPad, you're going to have, you know, you've got the bigger screen, you can multitask, you can do a lot more. There needs to be iPad-specific functions to give it that purpose. And I think that that's what Apple's working on right now.
Well, there still isn't a model for Sprint, but there are different versions for Verizon and AT&T networks.
My suspicion is that there will be a model for Sprint when Sprint deploys their LTE network, which I think is going to be this summer, because there wasn't a 3G version, you know, for Sprint that was going to be released, and that was the big thing, you know, for AT&T and for Verizon and for the European versions. That there was, you know, access to the 4G network, which was something that Apple devices hadn't started doing yet. You know, they had access to the 3G networks, but they hadn't access to LTE networks. And a lot of their competing devices, you know, particularly the Android tablets, have all had access to LTE for a little while now. So I think that that was an important thing for Apple to make sure that all of their devices were capable of.
The size, you mentioned the size changed a little bit. You said it might be due to a bigger battery or something, but can you use the same cases as with the iPad 2? Does anything functionally change when it comes to the size?
The explanation that I've been given was that if you have a gel case for the iPad 2, that it would probably stretch over the new iPad and not take it a little bit. But if you have a hard case, you know, you're probably going to need a new one because it's just slightly larger. So it probably won't fit in a hard case.
Terry in Columbus, you're on the air with Russell Holly. Welcome to the show, Terry.
Hi, thank you.
Go ahead.
My question is having an iPad 1, are you going to be in a situation where you really have to go to the iPad 3 as the technology is changing to be able to keep up with the apps? Are they going to be changing the apps significantly? It seems like you're always punished for getting the first generation of something.
That is definitely a mantra, in my opinion, is that the early adopter is often, kind of the butt of the joke as new things come out. And I will say that there's going to be a striking difference for people who've had the original iPad, who were to pick up the new iPad and go to use it. It's going to be significantly faster. It's going to, that the screen is going to make a pretty big difference. And the cameras that are set up are really, you know, going to be an interesting change to how you use the device.
Like how?
Well, I found myself with the iPad 2 really getting more engaged in, communicating with video, particularly when, you know, the iPad came out then Google's Hangout feature. I'm a big fan of the ability to video chat with multiple people at the same time, and the camera and the hardware in the iPad actually makes that experience really smooth, especially if I'm not at home or if I'm at a conference or something like that. I can set the iPad in a stand and communicate with all the different people that I work with at the same time. And you know, Apple has their own software for that as well with FaceTime to give you that one-on-one communication with somebody. And the iPad, because it's got the bigger screen, it makes it a lot more enjoyable to have that communication with somebody.
So, Terry, what are you going to do?
I'm probably going to be looking for an iPad 3.
It's called the new iPad. The new iPad. Just, you know, get your lingo right. Okay, Terry, thanks for your call.
Thank you.
Yep. What about sound quality? You said that the picture sounds better. It looks better when you're doing the hanging out. What about sound?
So nobody said anything about whether or not there are new microphones or new audio equipment installed in the new iPad yet, and we'll know more about that later this week, I'm sure. But assuming that they did do, you know, some kind of change to how the audio hardware was done, I can see it being much better for, you know, the microphone quality when it comes to talking to people. The only real issue that I had with the iPad 2 and the original iPad for doing this kind of thing was that the microphone wasn't really set up to handle multiple voices. You know, if we were having this conversation right now over an iPad and somebody else were to walk into the room, the microphone, you know, there's no software there to focus on my voice instead of the other person that walked in the room, so the conversation would become pretty cloudy. Whereas with a lot of video chat services, there's typically software that allows for that kind of cross communication to happen.
So overall, what's it cost?
Oh, it's going to be the same price as the original setup. You know, the 16 gigabyte Wi-Fi version is going to be $499, and it's going to they incrementally jump up from there. I think the most expensive version is almost $800 for a 64 gigabyte hard drive and access to, you know, Verizon's LTE network and you know, all the bells and whistles that go along with that. If you haven't pre-ordered one, the chances are good you're not going to see them in stores for a couple weeks. A lot of the things that I've seen say that, you know, the people who have been able to pre-order them to get them on the 16th so that they would be delivered to them on the 16th are going to get them. But for everyone else, there's going to be a bit of a delay.
And it won't kill them. How long have you been working with one? Or is it just what
I've
heard?
I was watching the product unveiling as they were messing with them on stage, and several of my colleagues were actually at the Apple launch event and messed with them. And so I'm kind of parroting a lot of the things that they've had. I haven't had the ability to touch one yet, but it looks like it's going to be an interesting thing.
So now this was the Apple launch that maybe a few years back they would have done in Las Vegas, but now they're doing it just on their own.
Oh, well, you know, they may have done that, you know, a couple of years ago, but yeah. Apple has had a history, you know, since the first iPhone was announced, you know, after that, doing everything in San Francisco, you know, as their own, you know, kind of private setup.
And it doesn't make any difference?
Well, I mean, it's certainly, you know, the only difference is that the people that are coming to see the event are certainly focused on, you know, Apple's products and no one else's at the time.
Anything else popping out in the next week that we might talk about coming up?
Sure. I've actually also been playing with the Samsung Galaxy Tab 7.7. Which is another tablet that Verizon's going to be offering. It's definitely different from the iPad. It requires, you know, a different set of thought. Comparing the two is a little difficult, in my opinion, because the Galaxy Tab 7.7, as the name suggests, is actually a 7-inch tablet and not a 10-inch tablet. And I actually kind of prefer these because they're easier to, you know, slide into a back pocket or slip into a book bag or something.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't feel like I lose a whole lot, with that screen size, but I'm also able to hold the device with one hand and walk around and not feel like I'm carrying this, you know, this big board.
I have
for a while. Exactly, a clipboard. And I've preferred the 7-inch devices personally, but a lot of people look at the 10-inch device as something that's bigger to watch movies on or to you know, browse the web on. But I personally prefer a 7-inch device.
Okay, well, Russell Holly, once again, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Russell Holly, he's tech blogger at geek.com. Thanks to the All Sides staff, producer Linda Taylor, associate producer Amy Jurevich, All Sides intern Corinne Gleckler, All Sides production assistant Ayan Sheik, and our new high school intern, Grace Bachman. Also, Alan DeCenzo is the composer of our theme music, WOSU News and Public Affairs Director Mike Thompson, Radio Operations Director Kevin Petrilla, Senior Broadcast Technician Eric French. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher. This is WOSU 89.7 and WOSU HD1 Columbus, streaming online at WOSU.org, 89.7 NPR News, a service of WOSU Public Media.